Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Marriage is complicated. We see so many inspirational quotes telling us marriage is a compromise, and it's true. But a compromise implies the consent of both parties. We meet in the middle. The Bible tells us, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. The love part is more important than compromising. The love has to be there first. And marriage is not for everyone. Some people are incapable of love. And some people will never be happy in a true partnership, which is also what a real marriage is. Stacy Scheck is one of those people I believe was not made to be married. Some people are just not emotionally equipped for the intimacy of sharing a life. And some are unwilling to compromise and be a true partner. Stacy was married 4 times before she married Richard Scheck. But this time, she didn't want a divorce when she wanted out. Happy Valentine's Day. On Valentine's Day, 2010, a 46-year-old man named Richard Scheck drove to Belton Bridge Park in Lula, Georgia. His wife, Stacy, had asked him to meet her there in a secluded area to exchange Valentine gifts. And then they were going to have a romantic getaway in the town of Lula, a tiny town with a population of around 3,000. The couple would do this often, go on adventures together, supposedly to keep the spice in their love life. Stacy got to the park around 9 p.m. and she called 911, hysterically reporting she had found her husband dead. He had been shot to death. Richard's body was lying next to his pickup truck. There was blood inside and outside of the truck. So it appeared he had been trying to run away from the truck, or maybe run back to it, as he was being shot. Stacy Scheck was not an immediate suspect, though she should have been. Richard's murder appeared to be completely random to police. There was no robbery. His jewelry and wallet were in the truck, and the truck alone was worth around $40,000. However, Belton Bridge Park isn't really a park at all. It's more of a parking lot. One Google reviewer called it Redneckville. There are no amenities, just a small boat ramp because it's right off the Chattahoochee River and Belton Bridge Road. There are no park benches, no grills, no playgrounds. As the Gainesville Times said, the only indication it's a park at all is a generic sign with the hours of operation, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Maybe that's why local police weren't all that surprised. The so-called park was really a hot spot for crime. Richard was the 5th person murdered there. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. First, a programming note. I misnumbered my previous episode. I moved my schedule around, but forgot to change the number. Sorry for the confusion. This really is episode 84. My bad, y'all. Now, here's the part where I usually give you the rundown of the small town where the victim lived. But it's not really crucial to this case. And I think the place he died is more interesting in its dark history. The Belton Bridge Park area was well known to local cops. People typically go there to party and drink, do drugs, or go mudding. But they also dump bodies there. And a few people have been killed there. Hall County Sheriff Steve Cronick said, quote, "You've got an area that's well isolated. Combined with that, you've got areas within the park that provide opportunities for concealment. After it rains, there's parts of the park we can't patrol with a Crown Vic. There's no lighting, and lighting is always a significant issue with the deterrence of crime. It just creates an environment that's more conducive to bad activities than good." I think local cops around the time of Richard's murder were more used to dealing with partying teenagers and drug deals. The last known murder was in 2004, 6 years earlier. But let's talk briefly about the earlier murders. On May 10, 1979, 45-year-old Edmund Turner's truck was found submerged in 5 feet of water in the Chattahoochee River at the Belton Bridge Park. He was in the back of the truck and had been shot in the head. Police also found a 38-year-old man named Jackie Morris, dead in a burned car nearby in Hall County. A few days later, 28-year-old Keith Fair and 27-year-old Dexter Thomas were charged with the deaths of Edmund and Jackie. Dexter, Keith, and Jackie Morris were all drinking and playing pool at Dexter's house on May 8, 1979. Edmund joined later that night. He was already drunk and was carrying a gun. Keith, Dexter, and Edmund were going to get more booze when Jackie decided to join. The four of them went and bought beer. Then they agreed to burn down the trailer of a man named Morgan Whitlock, who supposedly had Edmund arrested that day. Part of the agreement was that Edmund would pay Keith to burn down Morgan's trailer, but Edmund didn't pay Keith enough money. So naturally, as drunk rednecks do, Keith shot Edmund in the head. Then Dexter and Jackie put Edmund's body in the trunk of Jackie's car and headed back to Dexter's house. From Dexter's house, Keith told Dexter to follow him in Edmund's truck. He wanted to move Edmund's body to his own truck. They all met on a dirt road outside Belton Bridge Park, and Jackie put Edmund's body in Edmund's truck, and then Keith pushed the truck into the lake. Next, Keith said that they needed to burn Jackie's car because of any evidence in the trunk. But Jackie didn't really want to burn his car, so he asked if he could take the radio and tires. Then he could just tell his insurance company that the car was stolen. Keith said okay and offered to take the tires off the car himself. Keith pretended to have trouble taking the tire off, so Jackie went over to help. As Jackie bent over, Keith shot him in the head 3 times. Keith told Dexter to put Jackie's body in the front seat. After Jackie was in the front seat, Dexter leaned in and cut Jackie's throat with a pocket knife. Then Dexter and Keith set Jackie's car on fire. Keith was acquitted of killing Edmund, but he pled guilty to killing Jackie. He was sentenced to death for killing Jackie. Dexter was found guilty of killing Jackie and was sentenced to life. About 2 years later, on the night of August 10, 1981, 23-year-old Mark DeNoyer picked up 2 hitchhikers in North Carolina. 19-year-old William Page and 20-year-old Gregory Goins were hitchhiking on I-85 in North Carolina when Mark picked them up. Mark was heading back to his Fort Lauderdale house after visiting family in North Carolina. They stopped in South Carolina to buy beer, gas, and fireworks. As they drove along, they smoked some joints and took some pills Mark had. When they got to Georgia, they left the interstate hoping to find more drugs. When they couldn't find any drugs, William and Mark started arguing. Gregory was sleeping in the back seat and woke up hearing the fight. William and Mark started hitting each other. Mark reached to grab a pair of scissors he kept near the front seat, but William was faster. He had a pocket knife and pulled it out first. He stabbed Mark in the chest, killing him. Then he took over driving and drove for a few miles before he and Gregory dumped Mark's body. Around 6 weeks later, Mark's body was found in the Chattahoochee River, wedged between dead trees in the river and badly decomposed. It was the part of the river that backed up to the Belton Bridge Park. North Georgia police coordinated efforts and found a witness who had seen William driving Mark's car. William and Gregory were arrested and charged with murder. William was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison, where he's still incarcerated. Gregory was found guilty of voluntary manslaughter and was sentenced to 20 years. He has been released, though I'm not sure of the date. A more mysterious death happened in the mid-1980s. The very decomposed body of a woman was found in the park. She has never been identified and remains a Jane Doe to this day. On August 21, 2004, 20-year-old James Carlton Smith died after he was stabbed in the chest in Belton Bridge Park. James had been at a football game with 3 friends. After the game, they all headed to the park to party. Someone at the party got into a fight with another young man named James Grizzle. When James Smith tried to intervene, he was stabbed 3 times. He was taken to the hospital where he later died. The investigation was difficult for police. No one saw the 2 guys fighting, and only 1 person out of 15 said that they saw Grizzle with a knife. Grizzle was charged with the murder, but he was later acquitted. Aside from the usual partying and drug deals that go on in the desolate park, there has been violence. Cops patrol the area as best they can, but it's usually deserted or engulfed in rainwater, making patrolling impossible. So Belton Bridge Park was certainly a strange place for Stacy to ask her husband to meet her in the dark on Valentine's Day night. I'm going to pause now for a word from one of our sponsors. Imagine for a moment it's the year 2010. You leave your high-paying job at a blue-chip software company, come home, and do the same thing you've done now for weeks. You go to the medicine cabinet and take 4 or 5 painkillers from your cancer-stricken wife's never-ending supply. You crush them up into powder and wash it down with a tumbler of vodka. It didn't used to be this way, and it's about to get much, much worse. This is the story of Robert B., and he tells it on the powerful new podcast called Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. Each week, host Mike S. interviews and unravels true stories of people who fell down and have managed to get back up again. Subscribe and listen to Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. A link will be provided in today's show notes. Stacy Morgan Scheck was born on August 19, 1971 in Florida. I'm not sure of the exact city, but she did later attend Jacksonville University. Regardless, her mother's name was Rena, and her father died when Stacy was really young. Many psychologists would later say this made it difficult for her to form proper relationships. She had attachment issues. But the family must have moved around a bit, because Stacy graduated from Shiloh High School in Snellville, Georgia, in 1989, the small town she would later move to with her fifth husband, Richard. Stacy would also later claim that she was molested when she was a child by someone she has refused to identify. This doesn't make it not true. If anything, early childhood molestation explains some of her behavior later in life. She was a blonde and pretty teenager. She met her first husband at Shiloh High School, and they married shortly after graduation. Within 2 years, Stacy had filed for divorce. I want to point out at this time that I am not naming Stacy's former husbands. Not only were they difficult to research, they had nothing to do with the death of her fifth husband and deserve their privacy. At age 20, Stacy married again. Not long after, Stacy became pregnant with her first son, DJ. But she filed for divorce again when her son was still just a toddler, a year later. By now, Stacy really wanted to work on herself. So she enrolled in Jacksonville University in Florida and earned a degree in psychology and nursing in 1994. She got a job right out of college, but she was still floundering in her personal life. She met her third husband in 1997, but it only lasted 6 weeks. At this point, Stacy decided she would just casually date. She gave birth to another son, Keith, in 1998 while she still wasn't married. But she didn't care. Her career was taking off, and she felt in charge. But she felt a move was necessary to advance her career. She moved to Atlanta not long after the birth of her second child and became an administrator at a hospital. The position had a lot of potential for advancement. At this point in her career, she was advancing. But in her personal life, she was still just dating casually. But in 2001, she again thought she had found the right man. They married, and she had a third son named Kevin. The family moved to Snellville, a small town outside of Atlanta, where Stacy had gone to high school. On the east side of Atlanta, in DeKalb County, she got a job at Georgia Spine and Neurosurgery Center. She was again an office administrator. Her family was really happy. They all loved Snellville. But Stacy was still not content. She separated from her fourth husband in 2005. Stacy met Richard Scheck at the hospital she worked at. Richard was a graphic designer and a bit older than her. Richard Kevin Scheck was born on June 25, 1963, in Glenridge, New Jersey, to parents Edward and Marion. He was 44 when he met his 36-year-old future wife. He had no children of his own. Richard had graduated from Auburn University with a degree in art. He was an extremely creative, talented, and adventurous man. His family later characterized him as good-natured and fun-loving. definitely your arty type dude. And he had a passion for helping others. He was community oriented and was very compassionate. According to one coworker, Richard was, quote, a kind and gentle person who wanted to make everyone laugh. He never met a stranger. With his adventurous spirit, Richard loved hot air balloons. Not all of us do or can. We might like to watch them, but going up in one is different. But Richard loved them. He avidly took to the sky and a colorful balloon any chance he got. He had a motorcycle. He was a Boy Scout leader. He loved to cook and play soccer. In short, he was literally the ideal husband for a woman with three sons. In 2007, when he met Stacy, he was the facilities manager for a Gwinnett County medical building. He and Stacy headed up a summer scouting camp together and soon fell in love. Unlike previous husbands, Richard accepted Stacy's boys immediately. He loved children. There was no jealousy. He would come to adopt her two youngest boys, Keith and Kevin. Richard was also not at all put off by Stacy's numerous previous marriages. Richard really seems like an accepting, non-judgmental person in general. And it takes a great strength of character to want to be a step-parent, especially to three kids. But it takes even more to adopt those children as your own. Richard was that guy. He and Stacy married early in 2007 after they met. They eloped. They told everyone when they came back home. This was considered just another part of Richard's eccentricities. It was so like him to do that, spontaneous and loving. He just wanted to be with Stacy and the boys. He didn't need the bells and whistles of a big wedding. In a short essay-type book you can find on Kindle, author Anna Benton said Richard became a stay-at-home dad after their marriage. Stacy was the main breadwinner. I haven't seen that mentioned anywhere else, but outside of his community activities, I don't see another job for him after he married Stacy. I will not speculate as to whether or not this caused issues in their marriage. Stacy had a good job, and the boys were all school age. But she was a busy administrator for a surgery center, certainly a demanding job. And she also cared for her elderly grandparents, who lived about an hour and a half away. It makes sense that Richard, who loved to cook, was involved with Boy Scouts, would be a stay-at-home dad. The dad who picked up the kids from school and ferried them to various after-school activities before getting dinner ready as they waited for Stacy to get home. It seems like the best fit for everyone on the outside. I'm going to pause now for a final word from one of today's sponsors. Sometimes life can just be overwhelming. Whether you are suffering from grief or trauma, or maybe you're in the clouds of depression, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states treating depression, stress, anxiety, trauma, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges. And anything you share is confidential. And there is even financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code SOUTHERN. Why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/southern. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/southern. By 2010, when Richard was murdered, Stacy had already been carrying on a long-term affair. The man's name was Juan Rees, and he was also married. Later reports claim the affair had been going on for years. I've seen hints that Richard was a placeholder until Juan divorced his wife. I think that is largely unfair, and he had nothing to do with what was about to happen. But Stacy did shower Juan with gifts. She paid for his truck, his cell phone, and they took several romantic trips together. Stacy had used her considerable income to buy up rental properties, and she even let Juan and his family live in one. Juan worked at the spine clinic with Stacy, though he had no real medical training. Stacy later said Juan had worked as a security guard at a swanky hotel before his job at her clinic. So maybe he was just working security at the clinic. Later interviews with Richard's family indicate that he knew about the affair, but was still willing to work on the marriage. He wanted to save his marriage. But in January of 2010, Stacy decided she no longer wanted to be with Richard. But this time, she didn't file for divorce. Police later discovered she had taken out a $560,000 life insurance policy on Richard. That's a huge motive right there. And we have to consider that Richard had adopted her two boys. He may have tried to fight her for custody. After all, he was their caretaker, while Stacy worked crazy hours at the clinic. So in early January, she had lunch with a coworker named Lenitra. Lenitra was a 30-year-old single mom, and she also worked in the office as an administrator with Stacy. She was dating a man named Reggie, off and on at the time. He was the father of her 5-year-old son. So she and Stacy commiserated a lot. On this particular lunch date, Stacy told her friend she wanted to have Richard killed. She told Lenitra that she thought Richard was molesting her boys. Lenitra thought that her boyfriend Reggie might be willing to kill Richard, claiming he did work like this on the side for extra money. She told Stacy she would ask him and let her know. Stacy texted her a few days later to follow up, and Lenitra set up a meeting. Reginald Reggie Coleman was born on October 19, 1973, and according to Anna Benton, he had spent much of his younger life in the foster care system. Reggie was working as a personal trainer at the time of Richard's murder, and he was known as Mr. Results. He held boot camp sessions at the spine clinic and claimed to be a semi-professional boxer. He did have a record, but nothing violent. In 1992, in Philadelphia, Reggie was convicted of possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance, which made him a felon. From all appearances, he had cleaned up his life, though, despite what Lenitra said. On January 18, 2010, Stacy met with Reggie and asked him if he would kill Richard. She expressly told him that she believed her husband was molesting her kids. As a former foster kid, I'm sure this helped sway Reggie, along with the deal she offered. Reggie agreed, so they started making a plan. Lenitra said the killing should take place in a secluded area. Stacy suggested that Reggie kill Richard in Belton Bridge Park. Belton Bridge Park was near Stacy's grandparents' house, and she thought it would be a good place to murder someone. I'm sure the local cops would agree. The plan was, Stacy would tell Richard she wanted to meet him in Belton Bridge Park to exchange Valentine's Day gifts. She told Reggie that Richard would be killed with a single bullet to the head because she didn't want him to suffer. Then Reggie would stage the scene to make it look like a robbery had gone wrong. When the murder was complete, Lenitra would text Stacy saying, "Happy Valentine's Day." To pay for the murder, Stacy told Reggie she would give him $10,000 and give him her grandparents' 2009 Chevy Impala, which was valued at $15,000. To pay for Lenitra's middleman fee, Stacy told Lenitra she would give her the deed to the home she was renting from Stacy. As a convicted felon, Reggie couldn't and didn't own a gun, so Stacy took $600 out of an ATM and gave it to Reggie to buy the gun. He was supposed to dispose of it after the murder. On January 23, 2010, Stacy, Lenitra, and Reggie drove to Belton Bridge Park to run through the murder. After testing their plan, Stacy transferred $8,900 to Lenitra's account for her to cash and give to Reggie. And she gave Reggie the bill of sale for the Impala. She said she'd have the remaining $1,100 before the murder. Lenitra told Stacy she better get the money by Valentine's Day. If she didn't have it, then Reggie wouldn't go through with it. Stacy was true to her word. She transferred the remaining money to Lenitra on February 12th. On Valentine's Day, Stacy left work and drove to Cleveland, Georgia, where her grandparents lived. They needed 24-hour care, and she often drove an hour and a half from her job in Atlanta to take care of them until a night nurse came on duty. She and Richard lived in Snellville, Georgia, a small suburban town about 40 minutes from Atlanta and about an hour and 20 minutes from Cleveland. Stacy had a heavy commute both ways. Richard met her at her grandparents' house to wait with her, but Stacy told him to go on ahead to the park so they could exchange gifts. She said she would leave as soon as the night nurse got there. Remember, she had promised him a romantic getaway in the small town of Lula, right outside of the park. It was less than a 30-minute drive from Stacy's grandparents' home. Stacy said she was waiting for the night nurse, but she was really waiting on the signal from Lenitra, the text she was supposed to send once Richard was dead. She was still waiting when she got a call from Lenitra instead. She said Reggie needed to know what color Richard's truck was. Stacy told her, and they hung up, and about 30 more minutes passed. Finally, Stacy got the text from Lenitra. It said, "I forgot to tell you I'm coming in late for work tomorrow. By the way, happy Valentine's Day." And that was the code, meaning Richard was dead. To make sure Richard was dead, Stacy called his cell phone. When he didn't pick up, she left her grandparents' house and headed to Belton Bridge Park. At around 9 p.m., she found Richard's body and noticed that nothing went according to plan. Reggie didn't stage the scene to look like a robbery gone wrong, and he'd shot Richard way too many times. He had shot him 6 times, not one shot to the head as they had planned. She made the fake hysterical call to 911, and the police arrived shortly. They described the area where Richard was found as very secluded. There was no pavement or lights. Quote, "It's a very eerie place, especially at night." Richard's body was next to his truck. He had been shot 3 times in his chest and abdomen, 2 in the face, and 1 in the hand with a 9mm gun. The murder obviously wasn't a robbery gone wrong. Richard's watch was still on his wrist, his wedding ring was still on his finger, and there was $40 in the console of his car, as well as his wallet. Not to mention that the robber didn't steal Richard's $40,000 truck. After looking over the scene, police theorized that Richard got out of his car and walked towards a car he recognized, and once he was near the car, the driver started firing at him. It looked like he tried to run back to his truck. Some of the shots were at closer range, probably after he fell to the ground. The killer wanted to be sure he was dead. At first, they couldn't figure out why Richard would go to a strange car, or if he did recognize it, whose car was it? They found 3 distinct tire tracks: Richard's, Stacy's, and the mystery car. Well, obviously, the mystery car was Stacy's grandparents' Chevy Impala that she had given to Reggie as part of his payment. That's why Richard recognized the car. Stacy went to be interviewed at the police department right away. She seemed cooperative. She explained how she had asked Richard to meet her at the park because it was secluded and therefore romantic, the perfect place to exchange Valentines. Yeah, right. In a rundown parking lot where people do drug deals. Anyway, she said she called Richard's phone to let him know that she was running late, but got no answer. So she went ahead and drove to the park and saw Richard's body with her headlights. She said she called the police right away. But oddly, as the interview was ending, Stacy spontaneously admitted her affair with Juan Rees, to the surprise of the officers in the room. She told them it had gone on for years. She said it in an offhanded way, like she figured they would find out about it anyway, but it was no big deal. Of course, the police asked her if she thought Juan would kill Richard, but she said no, she didn't believe he would do that. But why else would she bring up the affair? Yeah, the police were probably going to discover the affair, but it sounds to me like she was casually throwing his name in the hat of suspects. And they did start investigating Juan Rees right away, as in, they went looking for him that night. But he wasn't at home. But the next day, on February 15th, they picked Juan up at work, at the spine clinic, and brought him in for questioning. Juan insisted he had nothing to do with the murder and offered to take a polygraph. The polygraph came back inconclusive, but Juan insisted he was trying to get back together with his ex-wife. He said he thought of Stacy as, quote, "means to an end." I'm not sure if he meant that she was basically his sugar mama or if it was to make his ex-wife jealous. Either way, Juan had an alibi. He and his ex-wife had rented a movie from Blockbuster on the night of Valentine's Day, and he spent the night at her house. That's why he wasn't at home when the police came looking for him. His ex-wife lived with her parents, and they all supported Juan's alibi. The police quickly dropped him as a suspect. And they were still investigating the scene. They needed to find out what kind of car those third tire tracks belonged to. They thought it could be the key to solving the case. The tires were found to be Goodyear Integrity tires. Police tried to narrow down the types of cars who had those tires, but they soon found that many different models of cars had those tires. Just when they thought they had hit a dead end, police got a call from an IT tech at the spine clinic. The tech said he was clearing out junk mail from Stacy's accounts when he noticed that her inbox was completely empty for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This was unusual. The tech told police that the clinic kept backups of all emails, and he would give those backups to the police. The police ended up with around 4,000 emails to go through. After digging through the emails, they found that one was a request to transfer $8,902 from a real estate account that the doctor's office had into the personal account of a woman named Lenita Ross. Police kept looking and found that she had also transferred $1,100 to Lenita's personal account on February 12th. This is even more interesting because I've never seen where Stacy was indicted for embezzlement. It's always portrayed in the press that she personally transferred the money, but she used an account where she worked to do it. Perhaps this was worded wrong in the report, because I see no other reason that they wouldn't have added that indictment. The police looked into Lenita Ross. They found that she had been renting a house from Stacy, so they went to talk to her there. When asked about the $8,900, Lenita claimed she received the money for home repairs. She had a deal with Stacy that she would do the repairs and Stacy would pay her. Next, police heard from Stacy's cousin, Connie. Connie said that she didn't know where her grandparents' Impala was. Stacy's grandparents had asked Stacy to sell their Impala and then use the money to pay their medical expenses. Stacy had told Connie she sold the car for $14,000, but Connie found that Stacy never gave the money to her grandparents. Police found the Impala at Lenita's house, and the Impala had Goodyear Integrity tires, exactly what they had been looking for. Police were starting to put the puzzle pieces together, but they needed solid evidence. They started thinking that from looking at the scene, the killer had waited there for Richard. While waiting, what would someone do? They might make a phone call. So police started looking into phone records. With Stacy's consent, police went through her phone. They found that Lenita and Stacy had been texting on Valentine's Day evening. Police also found that previous to Valentine's Day, Lenita and Stacy had talked on the phone and had texted about a money transfer. Police also obtained tower dump records from cell phone towers near Belton Bridge Park. Through the records, police found that Lenita and Reggie talked on the phone at around 8:40 p.m. on Valentine's Day. 8:40 p.m. is the time police believed Richard was murdered. It matched up with when Stacy had called his phone before she dialed 911 at 9 p.m. Next, police obtained Lenita and Reggie's phone records. They found that Reggie, Lenita, and Stacy had all been calling each other and texting for weeks. Police now knew about the money transfers, how Reggie had the Impala, and how Lenita had been gifted the house she rented. And then they discovered the big life insurance policy Stacy had taken out on Richard. In the meantime, Richard's funeral was held on February 20th at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Snellville. Because Richard was so artistic, attendees were asked to wear their favorite color to the service. Richard's family would later say that Stacy definitely played up the role as the grieving wife, weeping dramatically the whole time. Richard was cremated, and Stacy arranged to spread his ashes from a hot air balloon, his favorite pastime. How thoughtful. I'm sure you can hear the sarcasm in my voice, and Richard's family wasn't buying it either. They had suspected Stacy from the start, and were angry that the police hadn't arrested her. The police later said it was because it was a, quote, huge coordinated effort. They needed to serve 7 search warrants in 4 different counties and make 3 arrests all in one day. They called this Operation Tangled Web. Their biggest challenge was synchronizing the arrests so that the players wouldn't tip each other off. First to go down was Reggie. Then Lenita was nabbed at a traffic stop. And police then swooped in on Stacy at the location where so much of her planning took place, at her office. But someone had tipped her off that the police were in the building. She couldn't run, but she barricaded herself in a room where you had to have a key card to get in. She eventually surrendered without incident. All 3 were interviewed separately. Lenita claimed she didn't know what was going on. She said she was just an innocent bystander. Reggie just outright denied everything. Their last hope was Stacy. Police told her that they knew Lenitra and Reggie agreed to help her with the murder, but they didn't know why Stacy wanted Richard dead. Typical police tactic, divide and conquer. Lenitra and Reggie didn't fall for it, but Stacy did. Stacy admitted everything about the plan. She said the reason she had Richard murdered was because she believed he was molesting her kids. She said one of her kids actually told her Richard was molesting him. She wanted to protect her sons from what she had gone through as a child, and she didn't want to go to the police or get a divorce. She just wanted Richard dead. Stacy said she had told all of this to Lenitra, and Lenitra promised to ask her boyfriend Reggie. On June 10th, 2010, Stacy, Lenitra, and Reggie were all indicted for malice murder. Stacy and Reggie faced the death penalty. Prosecutors took the death penalty off the table for Stacy if she would testify against the others. Lenitra was offered a 20-year sentence if she testified against the others, but she said no. Lenitra did not want to testify against Reggie. He was the father of her son. Her trial began on May 15, 2012 in Hall County. The prosecution told the jury that Lenitra was the go-between. Quote, "She helped, advised, encouraged, hired, counseled, and procured the murder of Richard Scheck." The defense told the jury that the evidence didn't prove that Lenitra knew that it was a murder for hire. In fact, Lenitra thought Stacy was hiring Reggie for a carjacking. This is a random new theory thrown out by desperate attorneys. The defense insisted the jury shouldn't listen to anything Stacy testified about because she was, quote, "the most despicable person in this entire case." I don't disagree. In order to avoid the death penalty, Stacy testified at Lenitra's trial. She admitted to asking Lenitra to hire Reggie to kill Richard, and again said she did it because she thought Richard was molesting her boys. Because Stacy had been molested as a kid, she wanted to kill her son's molester. After police talked to her sons and they denied that Daddy Richard had molested them, Stacy claimed she realized she had been wrong. She was contrite on the stand. Lenitra Ross was found guilty on May 22nd. She was sentenced to life without parole. Her attorney argued for the lesser sentence, saying the prosecution had originally offered Lenitra a 20-year deal. He said she turned down the offer because it meant she would have to testify against Coleman, who is the father of her 5-year-old son. Quote, "The deal was not simply to take 20 years. The deal was also, you have to send your baby's father to death. It's one thing to accept responsibility, but it was beyond her to testify against the father of her child in a death penalty case. I understand what he means, and it was valiant of her to refuse to testify, but Lenitra still was just as guilty in setting up the murder of Richard Scheck." Lenitra appealed her conviction and sentence to the Supreme Court of Georgia. Her appeal was denied February 2, 2015. Originally, Reggie Coleman planned to go before a jury. His past as a foster child and his belief in Stacy's lies that Richard was molesting her children would play a large part in his defense. But on the first day of court in November of 2012, he rose and pled guilty. At sentencing, those issues were brought up, but he was still sentenced to life without parole, with an additional 5 years for firearm charges. The next month, in December of 2012, Stacy Scheck also pled guilty. At her sentencing, many victim impact statements were read in court, portraying a man who was a beloved uncle and stepfather and friend, a nonviolent, caring artist who loved everyone. When Stacy took the stand on her own behalf, she begged for mercy. Quote, "I said, I'm going to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. And that's what I did. And that's disgustingly awful." She also said, quote, "Someone told me the definition of mercy is getting what you don't deserve." Maybe so, but she certainly showed no mercy to Richard Scheck. Her mother, Rena Morgan, read testimony from Stacy's younger sons, who Richard Scheck had adopted. "I miss her every hour of every day, just like Daddy Richard," her 10-year-old son Kevin wrote. Stacy testified that she had truly believed that her husband had molested her oldest son Keith, and that's what led her to conspire to murder him. Keith denied the allegation, but Stacy insisted it's what she believed. Stacy's defense team tried to get the judge to consider mitigating factors, like the loss of her father at an early age and her own alleged past childhood sexual abuse. She had gone through a full psychological assessment to be sure she was fit to go to trial. But while the doctors found she may have had childhood trauma, she was not distraught at the time of the murder. Stacy Scheck had coldly and carefully planned the murder of her husband. Richard Scheck's sister, Carol Fillingham, told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, "She was such a cowardly woman that couldn't keep herself in control and had never had anyone that stood up to her. When you get too much power and control, you just believe you can do anything." I'm going to end this episode with a quote from a fictional writer, but one I think definitely applies to Stacy Scheck. Agatha Christie wrote, "I've never met a murderer who wasn't vain. It's their vanity that leads to their undoing. Usually, they're sure they've been far too clever to be caught." I think Stacy Scheck thought she was very clever, planning this on Valentine's Day in a deserted park notorious for crime. But she left a messy trail of evidence because, as Richard's sister pointed out, she was too cowardly to do it herself. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify and iHeart. I have recently joined Stitcher Premium, and for 1 month, you can try it out for free by using my promo code Southern Fried. After that, for about $5 a month, you can listen to Southern Fried and many other shows ad-free. Go to StitcherPremium.com and use promo code Southern Fried to sign up for 1 free month. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.